Jason Klom, and this is the Comedy on Vinyl podcast. Everybody, welcome to the show. Normally I introduce the year, the album, the artist, but we're going to be all over the place. My guest this week is Rob Newhart. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And so that I don't confuse anybody, and because you do sound significantly like your father, you're Bob Newhart's son.
Yes.
But we're gonna talk about your influences. We're going to talk, we talked about this on email, but one of the, I'm always blown away when I find out that somebody has done something where they've portrayed a relative, like in Chaplin.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it was Charlie Chaplin's great-granddaughter played his mother. There's a lot of that.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a Hollywood thing to do, mm-hmm. but in the movie Heart and Souls, which I absolutely love,
mm-hmm.
you play your dad.
Yes.
Very briefly.
Mm-hmm.
And you said there's a story about how that came. Now, first of all, is it your voice or is it a recording? I cannot remember. Is it?
It is my voice.
It is your voice.
It is my voice. They had it set up to where I was wearing an earpiece with one of the routines that they, on the day of the shoot, told me they were going to do. They gave me, I believe it was like 6 different routines that mm-hmm. they might use. And
oh my
so
gosh.
I memorized all of them, including the stammer and the pauses.
Yeah.
And had written it down and had memorized them. And then the day of the shoot, they came up and they said, okay, this is the one we're going to do. So they gave me an earpiece mm-hmm. and I mimicked along with what I was hearing in my ear.
Wow.
And so that was how the whole day came about.
Mm-hmm.
The way it all came about originally mm-hmm. was I was doing PA work at the time.
Uh-huh.
I was working in the entertainment business. And a friend of mine, Ben Schneider, his mom is Judy Bennett, who is a first AD.
Okay.
And they happened to be sitting at dinner one night, and she mentioned at the dinner table that they just couldn't find a good Bob Newhart lookalike. And my friend Ben laughed to himself, and he said, Mom, I think I can help you out on that. So I got a phone call from Ben saying that my mom may have worked for you, and I thought it was PA work.
Sure.
And then when she put me in touch with the director of the movie, he said, no, we want you to act. We want you to be in this scene. At the time, I had shoulder-length hair,
uh-huh.
and the scene was a period piece to where he was performing at what they laid out to be the Hungry Eye up in San Francisco,
right. yeah,
where
okay.
Dad used to perform.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, would you have any problem cutting your hair off? And I said, yeah. I wasn't crazy about it, but it was like, okay, yeah, this could be interesting, so
sure.
whatever needs to get done. So I did that. And got a crew cut and
mm-hmm.
And did the shoot. And it was a day shoot in downtown LA.
Uh-huh.
And it was a neat experience. It was awkward in the sense that when I was standing waiting to do my part in the scene,
mm-hmm.
They had a stage set up, a riser. And I felt the apprehension of getting up on stage
as if
I were actually performing.
mm-hmm.
And I thought about the apprehension that other stand-up comics must feel actually standing
right.
up in front of the stage. I'd experienced it behind the stage because I would
mm-hmm.
stand behind the curtain when I was growing up as a kid and would listen
sure.
to dad's routines and actually be out on the stage and would walk out on the stage after the performance was over and they were clearing the dishes.
Right, right.
But to actually stand in front of an audience was a different experience. It gave me an appreciation for it.
How big of an audience? I mean, there were actually extras there, right? Yeah.
There was probably a crew of maybe about 50,
uh-huh.
and there were probably about 30 or 40 extras.
Okay.
It was all dark in the back, so I couldn't really see all that well.
But you knew they were
but,
there.
Yeah, I knew they were there. I knew the cameras were there initially and then forgot about it.
Yeah.
And the well-known actor and actress, or the well-known actress in the scene was Kara Sedgwick.
Oh, right, yeah.
So mine was just a transitional scene to where I was performing a character as Dad, mm-hmm. and they were having an argument in the middle of the bar, and she says, I don't want to have this argument here. And
mm-hmm.
my line was, how about up here? I'm almost done.
My
problem with it is that I got caught up in how my dad would say it. So I kept saying, what about up here? I'm almost done. And they did two different cuts of saying, no, the line is this. And so eventually I get it right. But
that's so good. I mean, my first thought is, the reservation that some people might feel on a number of levels. Number one is, like, sometimes if you've got a famous parent, If you don't have a great relationship with them, mm-hmm. that's going to be problem number mm-hmm. one. You just want me to play my dad. I don't mm-hmm. want to deal with that. Then you've got number two, where like, I've got a whole legacy mm-hmm. that I've got to deal with here. Mm-hmm. And so then there would be that reservation as well.
Yeah.
Did you feel any of the legacy-based, like, obviously you're fine doing it because, you know, there's no bitterness, but mm-hmm. like, how was there just like, well, I'm playing my dad. I got to do him right.
Well, I had gotten it correct. I knew his mannerisms well mm-hmm. and things that he would do, and I wanted to really do it right. I wanted mm-hmm. to do the mannerisms well because they didn't tell me how close up the shot would be.
Oh, sure, yeah.
To where they would see, well, this guy is not lip-syncing well.
Right.
So I over-prepared, I believe.
Okay.
And really tried to nail it and did the mannerisms as I've seen him do it numerous times.
Yeah.
And the stammer and the blinking.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah, I put some time into it to make sure that it was going to look as fluid as possible, that it wasn't labored in a sense.
Yeah. But was there any sort of response from the audience, from the crew, like genuine response? Like,
I didn't get a response from the audience.
Okay.
It was funny, I did get a response when I was walking to the set and I was wearing one of those old 60s polyester suits.
Sure.
And someone stopped me on the street without knowing I was going to the shoot and says, "Has anybody ever told you you look like a young Paul Newman?"
Ah,
and so
I love it.
Felt kind of good going into the whole situation.
Of course.
Well, at least I got a compliment from it.
Yeah,
but,
right.
I didn't get a response from that a couple of weeks later, a couple of weeks or months later, I can't remember which,
mm-hmm.
When I still had the residual of the crew cut,
mm-hmm.
I was down with my family in Florida. Dad was getting an award for, I believe, the Television Hall of Fame down there
okay.
at Disney. And they had one of his promo posters. It was a very famous one where he's wearing a black suit.
Mm-hmm.
He's got his hands tucked in his pants with kind of a sheepish
oh, yeah. Yeah, okay.
smirk on his face. Well, I happened to be standing in front of that in the black tux without realizing it was behind me and heard a gasp. And I look over and my entire family is looking at me and then they're looking at the picture and they're looking back at me. And then I looked at it and realized what they were looking at. So, yeah, I've gotten that in the past. I've had
yeah.
people ask me, said, "You look a lot like him."
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
But then again, he's also gotten that question, which allows him to sidestep.
I love it.
They'll
yeah.
ask him, they say, "Has anybody told you you look a lot like Bob Newhart?" Says, yeah, I get that a lot. And that's kind of when he doesn't want to really talk about it.
Of
if they
course.
Don't ask him directly.
Yeah.
He'll say, yeah, I get that a lot.
Sure, of course. That's perfect. And I, at the very least, now, the stammer being a character thing, mm-hmm. how much of it is affected? Because I'm sure.
Actually, the stammer is natural. There's
yeah?
a,
okay.
It's a pause in thought. I have the same thing, which is why I'm pausing right now,
because sure.
I tried to break myself of it over the years,
mm-hmm.
rather than using filler words such as "you know" or yeah. what people will use for it.
Mm-hmm.
But there is that pause. Sometimes it's part of the act and part of his routine to
sure.
to where it builds up the expectation of what's coming next.
Mm-hmm.
But part of it was also his natural hesitancy.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, that makes me think nowadays, if I were to pick apart an act I enjoy and cut out all those filler words,
mm-hmm.
I wonder what how those pauses would feel, actually, now that I think about it. Because,
well, they
had, you know?
They had he tells a story when he was doing the Bob Newhart show where they were running over on one of the episodes,
mm-hmm.
and some of the writers came to him and said, you know, we need to tighten up the show.
Sure.
Can we take some of these pauses out? His response was, well, those pauses got me a house in Beverly Hills.
Right.
So
right.
It's like he equated it to Jack Benny and saying, you know, "Take my wife, please."
Sure, sure, sure.
Or Henny Youngman.
Yeah, you're
or,
right.
Or your money or your money or your life. I'm
yeah.
thinking rather yeah. than that long pause that he uses that builds up the tension and the laughter
sure.
in the audience.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I had always wondered because I had a feeling it came from him naturally. But
mm-hmm.
once you know that you do it, you mm-hmm. can use it as a tool. And I think it's a great comedic tool.
Yeah, it can be off-putting at first. But
sure.
then when he started to realize that it actually enhanced what he was doing, I believe mm-hmm. it probably became a conscious thing as well as an unconscious thing.
Yeah. I definitely want to talk about what it was like growing up in a house with a guy who sold the most comedy albums of all time at this point. But I also want to talk about your own interests and influences in comedy, because some people might also, same thing, might also avoid comedy if they grow up in a quote-unquote comedy house. But you definitely did have some stuff that, that you were influenced by or were interested in.
Absolutely.
What's the first comedy album you ever, what, was it one of your dad's, or was it something that you remember being exposed to?
The one that I remember that was, that I felt excited about was Richard Pryor's albums.
Yeah.
When we knew that Dad was a big Richard Pryor fan, always was. And when he sat us down to let us listen to the a Richard Pryor album, you know, the As Blue As He Could Possibly Be.
Sure.
That was sort of like our entrance into it. I mean, I had watched a lot of different comics over the years. I was a big fan of Jonathan Winters. I used to love watching the Jonathan Winters show.
Of course.
Growing up, we went to a lot of the roasts, the Friars Club roasts, which were very similar to the Dean Martin roasts. So I got to see a lot of them perform their acts, but not really listen to their albums.
It was
really, Richard Pryor was one of the first ones. George Carlin was another one that was a big influence on me, because I loved words, and his wordplay was just fascinating.
Yeah.
Plus, he was also, he wasn't pretentious. He was very straightforward about what he noticed, what he wasn't hiding. And I admired that. Bill Cosby as well. Robin Williams. I was a big fan of Jonathan and Darlene Edwards.
I don't know them.
If you can find the albums, they're hysterical. They're professionally trained musicians and singers.
Okay.
She's a singer and he's a musician. He plays the piano and she sings. But they put together an album called Jonathan Darlene Edwards. It's not their actual names, I don't believe. But they will do classics and do them. She'll sing off key and he will play the piano, throwing in additional notes that are off rhythm. So he'll rumble through it. And it's, they do like a little bumblebee. And she's balls around, balls around, balls around. And you can hear that she's, her pitch is getting higher and she's not going to be able to hit the notes later on in the song,
awesome.
Which just makes it funnier and funnier. And he will add additional notes into what he's playing to where all of a sudden the beat will stop, but his fingers will still be going up the keyboard. But blim, 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 blim.
That's awesome.
And wow. And they do the Chattanooga Choo Choo. They do Little Bumblebee. They do like some really good standards, but they do this really warped take on it, and it's hysterical. And I love that. Tom Lehrer was another one that that I really liked. When you and I were corresponding via email, Firesign Theater was another one.
Were those the ones, were these more counterculture ones, without a better word for it, were the ones you discovered on your own?
I liked the ones that had the edges. I mean, I liked Bill Cosby, but I liked George Carlin more.
Yeah. Did you discover it on your own, or were some of these through, I mean, obviously Pryor was through your dad, you said, but did you discover any of these on your own?
I discovered them through Dad. I discovered them through, if Dad were a singer, I would be more interested in following singers, but because he was a comedian, I tended to follow more of the comics, because that's who he was around, and therefore focused more on comedy and really enjoyed comedy more, so I gravitated more towards that. It's no longer there anymore. There is I believe it was a Warehouse Records in Westwood Boulevard, and I believe it was in high school, and I went in there, and I was looking through the comedy albums. I was looking to see, you know, if there were albums of Dad's, and if they were selling out, or they were just still there. And I looked to my left at one point, and there's George Carlin standing there. So I didn't want to approach him the way most people normally did.
Sure.
And at the time, I was going to high school with his daughter, Kelly.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Kelly does a podcast, and she's got a very good stage routine that she's doing now.
Oh, it's brilliant, yeah.
And so I turned to him, and I said, "You're Kelly's dad." And he, And he laughed to himself. And he said, yes, I am. And he goes, who are you? And I said, I'm Rob. And he goes, Rob who? And I said, Rob Newhart. And he goes, oh, you're Bob's son. And so I kind of went, yeah, I shouldn't have played with fire on that one. But but it was neat that he was so approachable. And
yeah.
He was just really neat to see. But, I would go to the comedy sections, and I'd see different ones that were in there and have grab different albums or would find ones that Dad had, because he had several racks of just different albums
sure.
and people that influenced him.
Mm-hmm.
Everything from George Burns and Gracie Allen to Jack Benny, just a lot of them. But
yeah.
The one that really stood out was he loved Richard Pryor.
Yeah, that's
he
so
loved
good.
The way he could tell stories. And years later, when they gave Richard an award, they asked Dad if he would go to the show, and he says, only if you allow me to give him the award. And so they said, okay.
Awesome.
So he gave him the award, and they were taking pictures in front of the photographers later. And I think this is when Richard was in a wheelchair at the
okay.
time.
Yeah.
And Richard leans over and says, you know, when I was growing up, I used to go to the record store and I used to steal your albums and listen to them. And Dad kind of jokingly said, you know, I got paid 25 cents an album for those. And so Richard kind of leans up, looks around the room, and says, someone got a quarter?
Yes, yes, yes. Oh, my God. There's so much beautiful cyclicalness in that story. There's just mm-hmm. so much. Like, I love hearing when, because I'm not dumb enough to assume that your dad was square or mm-hmm. is square. But, like, obviously, he's called the button-down mind. Mm-hmm. Obviously, he's got this
yeah.
image. And it's wonderful to hear that he loves mm-hmm. somebody who is part of the counterculture,
mm-hmm.
you know,
yeah.
Richard, you know, and it's great to hear those influences, and it's really cool that you felt like, well, this is something I can latch on to, and it's
yeah.
not, doesn't have to be the same thing I'm used to hearing.
Mm-hmm.
What's the first time you heard Fire Sign? That I'm curious about.
God, I want to say it was in college. The one that stood out for me was the Guess That Disease routine that they did.
Uh-huh.
Which I just thought was so clever and was mm-hmm. so funny. But there are so many. Pastor Flash and the Glorious Assumption of the Blinding Light.
Mm-hmm.
That was another one that I liked.
Did you have any of them memorized? Were you that kind of
oh,
listener?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, blinding light. Oh, light that blinds I cannot see. Look out for me. And just laugh and laugh and laugh. I can't remember those. I had... a lot of the Tom Lehrer ones,
mm-hmm.
and I tend to because of the way Dad was, because what is normally not seen and was especially obvious to me in his earlier years was there was a really sick side of things.
Uh-huh.
It kind of came out in Abe Lincoln when he's talking about that, and then ends it. Why don't you go to a play? I was listening to one before I came over here, sort of refresh my memory on a few things, and he has one about Edison's greatest discovery.
Yes,
where he has them come into a room and he turns the light bulb on and the light fills the room and they want to go out and file their reports. He goes, no, 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 that's not it. And leans into the microphone or leans into the light bulb and goes, hello? So there is that kind of twisted side, and I love with Tom Lehrer, you had Poisoning Pigeons in the
oh,
Park.
Oh, God, so good.
I was raised Roman Catholic, so there was the Vatican Rag, which I loved.
Uh-huh.
Dad was also very much into current events. He really stayed current on that. It's like the Khrushchev landing rehearsal, which now
yes.
doesn't hold up, but at the time, it was very topical. And some of the Tom Lehrer routines, he was very topical and very clever on.
Right.
And so I gravitated towards those.
Mm-hmm.
So I always gravitated towards the edgier ones, the Robin Williams. And then later on, one of my favorites was, of course, now I'm going to blank out on the name. Then I'll remember it.
It's okay.
I'll remember it.
Bill Hicks. Okay, of course. Yeah, that guy was a revelation. A little late for me because it
yeah.
was for in college for me. He'd been dead already. But mm-hmm. like, whoa, my goodness. At some point, although I don't think he ever had anything released on vinyl. Maybe he did. I think we should do an episode about him, even though we try to stick to vinyl. But yeah. He's like so influential, it would be hard to avoid it.
Yeah, I remember the first time that I saw him was the HBO half hour comedy special.
Yeah.
And from the very first line when he came out, and just to take on the audience when he starts talking about non-smokers, he gets them, goads them into it, and yep. then he calls them a bunch of pansies and pulls out a pack of cigarettes and starts smoking on stage. And I immediately just started, I said, I gotta watch this guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And another one which Dad, to this day, still loves, Eddie Izzard, is another just clever one, but it's a different style of comedy.
Right.
But it's clever, and he's also well educated and has studied the things that he talks about. Right. So it's an intelligent comedy.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was actually one thing in I don't think I would have ever questioned his intelligence, but your dad's comedy is very approachable.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, I mean, selling as many as he did.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, even in listening, we were talking about on the way up here, Bob Newhart faces Bob Newhart mm-hmm. faces Bob Newhart, and on the back it does continue to say faces Bob Newhart.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few moments in here where he's using words that are, you know, your $4 words. Mm-hmm. He's using some quote unquote big words mm-hmm. that you're not going to find in a lot of comedy nowadays that's approachable.
Mm-hmm.
And the audience loved it.
Mm-hmm.
He obviously knows what he's talking about. And it's a simple thing. I can't even remember what the word was. It was a very, mm-hmm. it was a word that I understood, but I feel like I don't, again, it's pat to talk mm-hmm. about people, the dumbing down of America, mm-hmm. blah, 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 blah. But it is interesting that he could be as approachable and also be at mm-hmm. no point talk down to them.
Well, yeah, he was very good about that, in that he made it approachable, but the way he, because I asked him at one point about how he structured his act or structured his routine.
Yeah.
Because for me, there were different periods in his life, and my siblings had more experience in different other periods in his life. My period primarily were the albums and the first show. Those are the ones I remember most fondly, although
sure.
I do remember the other periods, but those are the ones that I really focus on and am familiar with. And would talk about how he would script his jokes, and he would talk about the trap doors that he would put into the jokes. So
mm-hmm.
if things weren't going well, because the first few minutes of an act is usually the comic putting out a variety of different jokes and then seeing how the audience responds to it,
sure.
and therefore being able to gauge what kind of an audience he has, and then gearing the rest of the jokes based on the first couple of jokes that he had.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the jokes that Dad tells was, which has that sort of layered effect of people catching the joke at different intervals.
Sure, yeah.
And only until they don't completely get it do you basically spell it out.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about a story that George Shearing, the blind jazz pianist, tells about going on a flight from New York to Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
But they would have stopovers along the way in St. Louis or wherever. And in one of the stopovers, the pilot knew that George was on board, and he came back and says, George, we're going to be on the ground for half an hour. Would you like to get up and walk around? And he said, no, I'm just starting to fall back to sleep.
Uh-huh.
And so the captain said, well, what about your guide dog? Because at the time, and maybe
sure.
it's still the same way, you could take the guide dog on the plane. So George says, that would be very nice of you. And so the captain takes the guide dog.
Mm-hmm.
30 minutes later, they start to reload the plane. No one's getting back on the plane
because
uh-huh. they had seen the captain walking with the guide dog through the terminal.
Uh-huh.
Well, the way that he structures that was that as soon as he says, so the captain takes the guide dog,
mm-hmm.
you get a certain rumbling in the crowd of
sure.
people who could see what's coming.
Uh-huh.
Oh, no. 30 minutes later, they start to reload the plane. A new group of people start laughing
because right.
now they're catching it. And then the final, you know, they had seen the captain walking with the guide dog. So
right.
He made it approachable on different layers
yeah.
to where people could get it. And I think to a certain extent, the people who got it earlier, there is a certain pride in
oh,
being
yeah.
able to anticipate it and see what was coming.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't dumbing down to their
right
to their intelligence or their insight.
I always kind of, I kind of like to track that on certain albums or anybody that I'm listening to, like, especially if it's a live album, of mm-hmm. course, I'm like, wait, what did I just miss? Like, you mm-hmm. know, I know that I missed the first wave, and I'm like, oh, I got it now. Like, it's always interesting. Like, I guess it depends on the delivery or, you know.
It depends on the delivery. There are certain techniques also, such as what they call callbacks.
Sure.
Which they refer back to something that they talked about earlier in the act, and it gets a big laugh because people remember from the earlier one, and it's just, the whole idea of the reference back to what they talked
sure,
about earlier.
Sure, sure.
Or how they were able to integrate it all the way into an act rather than it seeming right. like it's a stream of consciousness that they're
doing. Of course, right. I'm realizing I have not seen Heart and Souls in a while, so mm-hmm. what bit did you end up doing?
That's a good question. I don't remember.
Because I love that movie, but I think I just always just remember my mom said, oh, you know, that's his son. And I'm like, what the are you kidding me? Blew my mind.
It may have been Abe Lincoln.
Okay.
Because I remember having to work with a mock phone, if I remember correctly, but I couldn't say with any certainty. I think there were six different routines. They gave me the driving instructor. Gave me King Kong. They gave me, I don't know if they gave me Grace L. Ferguson.
Okay.
And Abe Lincoln. But then the day of the shoot, they said, okay, we've decided to do that. So I scampered into this little trailer that they gave me, and I'm like, okay, remember.
Oh, my God. That's that kind of pressure, that hurts my brain a little bit. Did you learn anything new about comedy from just having to do that?
I gained a new level of respect for it. I already had respect for it.
Sure.
Because I had been around the stand-up comics, and there's a different breed of, I don't want to sound cliche, but there's a different breed of danger in doing stand-up
mm-hmm.
versus being a singer in a band. Not to denigrate people who are sure. in a band, because there are a lot more elements in a band, whereas with stand-up, you're basically flying without a net.
Yeah.
You screw up, and it's you.
Mm-hmm.
And so to see the comic out there doing their routine and it not working, I saw it as courageous.
Yeah.
And some of the, I heard stories about, all stand-ups have had those nights where they call it going up.
And yeah.
Just nothing works.
Yeah.
And Dad had them before. Stories about Richard Pryor doing 15 minutes of his best stuff
mm-hmm.
and stopping after 15 minutes and saying, look, I've just given you the best that I can do.
Right.
If you haven't left yet, or you haven't laughed yet, you're not going to laugh. And he walked off the stage. Rowan and Martin used to do what they called the Olympic sprint race,
mm-hmm.
where they were doing their routine on stage and they would say, you want to do the Olympic sprint race? Yeah, sure. And they got down in the sprint position
uh-huh.
and sprinted right at the middle of the audience
uh-huh.
and right out the door and just went right back to their rooms.
That's
and everybody's
so
still expecting him to come back, but no, they were gone for the evening.
That's
but,
so funny. That's the interesting thing about people's different approaches to bombing.
Because
mm-hmm. there are some comics who will just screw it. I'll stick with mm-hmm. this time. Just because only based on, image, I can't assume that your dad would ever do that kind of thing. Just leave.
Well, yeah, his they always have the little catchphrases of how they deal with comics or hecklers. The mm-hmm, one I mm-hmm. loved was Steve Martin's, where it was, I remember when I had my first beer.
Yes, right. I love that.
And dad's was same to you, fella.
That's on the cover of one of his albums, isn't it? It is. It's on.
There was in, I think it was.
There we go. Behind the button down mind.
I think it was the button down mind. It was a line from the driving instructor.
Yes, right.
When
there we
some,
go. Yeah, yeah,
somebody
yeah.
was supposedly honking at him, and mm-hmm. he yells out the window, "Same to you, fella."
Mm-hmm. That's right. And he's got that on the cover of Behind the Button Down Mind, written on his back, which I mm-hmm. think is fantastic.
So, yeah. So everybody has different approaches to it, and.
Sure.
You do the best you can, and then you have comedians who can fearlessly go at it. Like, you know, one of Dad's best friends is Don mm-hmm. Rickles.
Yeah.
And Don, obviously that's not the real person, the stage presence. He's a really sweet man, but there is that people are almost insulted if they're not attacked by him.
Right, right, of course.
And so he could be aggressive that way. And then you also had other people who almost enjoyed pissing off the audience, such as an Andy Kaufman.
Sure, sure.
He sort of took the Jack Benny silence thing to its extreme.
Yeah.
Of, you know, like the famous Mighty Mouse routine,
yes,
where he would just drive people nuts by just not saying anything for 5 minutes, and then he would do something, and then he would go quiet for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And he, not just the Mighty Mouse, but other things I heard in his act, he would stand there for 5 minutes, and people would stare at him.
Yeah.
And just, aren't you going to do anything?
But right.
He could live that way.
Right. Did you ever, okay, so I have to assume you did, but after, you know, you move out on your own, mm-hmm, and stuff, were you a regular, do you still go to watch live comedy? I'm curious.
Actually, I never really watched that much live comedy. I've seen, mm-hmm, I've gone to different places. I've gone to the Comedy Store. I've gone to the Improv before.
Mm-hmm.
And I've watched a little bit, but I never felt compelled to really go to those places. I listened to albums a lot more. I would find myself watching, thank goodness for Comedy Central, but I would,
right,
find myself watching that. I would always gravitate towards the HBO specials before they actually had the full-on comedy specials now that,
mm-hmm,
that you can watch a lot, or you can watch on Netflix.
Sure.
So I would look forward to those, and there was a point where those only came on late on a Saturday night after Saturday Night Live was on, so, mm-hmm, I would stay up late to watch that and see what comedians they would put on.
Mm-hmm.
And so I enjoyed that, but now with Comedy Central in the evenings, I can watch what I want to watch or watch Netflix.
Sure, sure, sure. That's the one thing that's making up for the lack of comedy albums, because it's, you know, that's why I have to buy all old, mm-hmm, old comedy albums. At the very least, you can pull up some new stuff on Netflix,
yeah,
you know. By the way, real quick, just a side little promotion, Eugene Merman's special is fantastic. I just watched, mm-hmm, it last night. It's really brilliant.
Huh.
Very weird guy. Very funny guy, though. So... when's the first time, so like I said, like we were talking about, when I grabbed this album, I just out of nowhere decided to play it today, just, mm-hmm, to listen to some new material, mm-hmm, new material to me by your dad, and track one, side two, is about you, and that's just, that was a perfect coincidence, but I'm, mm-hmm, wondering the first time you heard that was.
That, I can't remember that routine. Now I'm going to have to, okay, listen to it, because I have some
MP3s at home. I got it queued up if you want me to play it.
Now I'm a little nervous about listening to it. He used to use us in his act, and,
uh-huh,
in the later years, it would depend on which one of us happened to be in the audience, because, mm-hmm, when we were together as a family, he would pick and choose about who he would use for a specific routine in his act, and then later on, if he were performing on the road and one of us wanted to come and visit him and see the act, mm-hmm, then the fact that we were there, he would use it, and it was about, he was talking about raising his kids Dr. Spock.
Uh-huh, okay.
And how, you know, the whole idea is when you want to potty train them, you go to the bathroom, you invite the kid into the bathroom.
Oh, right, yeah.
You pretend it's fun, therefore the kid will think of it as fun and want to do it that much sooner.
Sure.
And he would invariably say, Rob, you want to come in the bathroom and see how much fun Dad's going to have? So that was always an embarrassment when it was like, oh,
God.
God. And then later on, he had a, he does a bit at the end of his act where he does this like little film montage of, mm-hmm, the supposed history of the Newhart family.
Okay.
And it's a lot of pictures, some clips of him and Rickles on vacation, which people love to see.
Sure.
Plus pictures of us. And so I really specifically remember the whole Dr. Spock section of going, okay, he's using one of us. But that I can't specifically remember.
Okay. Okay. It's just so funny because I was like, because I realized I didn't, A, know how many children he had. I'd done, mm-hmm, very little research on that because I know the comedy. I,
yeah,
normally don't really care too much about someone's personal life. It's not of interest, but obviously it became of interest today. So it was a very perfect point. Is this actually a really great album? And it's, what is it, his fourth or fifth, maybe, mm-hmm, sixth, within 4 years?
Yeah.
I forget how many he had to release just over and over
He had two in 1 year,
mm-hmm,
and they were actually both at the top of the album charts for a couple decades, because I,
right,
remember that Use Your Illusion 1 and 2 by Guns N' Roses came out, and that beat the record of an album getting the first and second spots. And someone happened to notice that and mention it to Dad in an interview, and he says, well, at least it went to a friend. they came out. There was a radio DJ, it was a friend of his in Chicago. I believe his name was Dan Sorkin, I could be wrong. When Warner Brothers Talent Scout came into town, said, is there anybody you think that is good? And gave him some of the things that Dad had done. And so Warner Brothers liked it. And at the time, Warner Brothers Records as well as Warner Brothers Comedy were not doing well at all, apparently.
Okay.
And they listened to it and they liked it. And they said, well, yeah, we're very interested in recording your act. Where's the next place you're going to perform? And he says, well, I've never performed before. And he hadn't. He had written routines, but he had never performed before. So they looked around and tried to find places, and most places wanted someone who had actually performed, not someone who had never performed before.
Sure.
And they found a place down in Texas called the Tidelands.
Right.
And that's where they did they did 2 weeks of recordings and pieced together the Button Down Mind.
I had wondered how long that had been that he was doing that for, because the story is always, you can tell me if this is true or not, the story is always that he was doing it just at house parties for friends, right? Is that basically it?
He was doing it to amuse himself and amuse a friend of his.
Okay.
He was working, I believe, in marketing or as an accountant, and they would do prank phone calls to each other over the phone, where he would call up and say, hi, I'm calling from the yeast factory where we're having a fire here, so the firemen are here. I'm going to have to call you from the third floor. No, make that the fourth floor. They would crack each other up
back and forth.
And so he enjoyed it and noticed that since he didn't have a family at the time, he could take the chance of saying, well, what if this is something that I could be good at? So decided to give it a couple of years to see if he could go about writing comedy and whether it would take him anywhere.
That's gutsy. That's really gutsy. Yeah. Especially to be in something that takes some skill.
Yeah.
To do what he was doing and just drop it.
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy. That is crazy. And then to hit the perfect, it's perfect for him. Hit the perfect mark for when records were going to be big.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say that he wasn't responsible for some of that blow up himself, but it was good timing, obviously.
Yeah.
Do you remember the first time that maybe an album was a big deal and how one of his, like, being released? Or was it ever a big deal? Was it just
I don't remember it ever being a big deal.
Okay.
I would remember people coming to the meet and greets after his shows, and some would bring an album.
Sure.
Not always. As the years pass, people tend to bring more albums,
of course,
and would have him sign them. But
early
on, I don't really remember it. It could be possible, but I just remember people wanting to come backstage and meet with him, and then later on, I would see more albums of people saying, "Can you sign this?"
Mm-hmm.
So.
And that, obviously that's you're just used to that growing up. You'd just be used to this is how life is. But was there ever any interest? And I know this is kind of a trite question, but I do have a genuine curiosity. Was there any interest on your part ever to be a performer?
I had thought about it. I think I had an appreciation for what it took. I felt to a certain extent that I had the talent for it. I didn't have the temperament for it.
Okay, yeah.
Because whether you are successful or not, going into it, you have to accept the possibility that if something happens, that you don't become that nasty, resentful person of leave me alone, this is my personal life. This is something that they chose, and there's a possibility. And I didn't love it enough to where I said, okay, if that were to happen, then this is a worthwhile sacrifice.
Sure.
I wasn't compelled by it. I liked it. I didn't love it.
I feel invariably you'd have too many comparisons drawn by other people,
mm-hmm.
and then you'd inevitably probably be drawing them yourself eventually, right?
Well,
I could be wrong.
Initially, yeah. Mm-hmm. I've heard that over the years, as if it were something that, for the rest of someone's life, would always carry them through.
Sure.
Initially, sure. The way I saw it was there's an initial curiosity, and to a certain extent, there is an observation that someone like in my position who had a well-known father and mm-hmm. was able to observe his work could pick up certain things.
Right.
And that would therefore influence my comedy, but I would also listen to other comics. So
yeah.
I wouldn't be a mirror image of him.
For sure.
I would be influenced by him, plus I'd be influenced by other people, and therefore hopefully have my own voice, or yeah. eventually would have my own voice, such as anybody else who goes into that career.
Oh, absolutely.
They may be influenced by other people, but eventually find their own voice and what works for them.
Sure. It just becomes so hard when you see people, specifically like media or people who are reviewing or doing what mm-hmm. I do, being unable to separate those two, mm-hmm. you know, and then that's where the unfair comparisons yeah. come from, not giving somebody the chance to shine on their own and do whatever the hell they want to do. And I was just trying to think, like, how many people have even followed, in terms of stand-up, have even followed their parents, mm-hmm. like Rainn Pryor, of course.
Yeah.
And what Kelly's doing is her own version. She's been on the show, so she's a friend of the show, and I love her mm-hmm. show, but it's obviously not stand-up. It's mm-hmm. her own thing, and I did point out, though, that she can swear as well as her father, and it's
oh,
fantastic.
Yeah.
It makes me very happy that
yeah.
she's got such a great voice for those words. I'm trying to think, maybe there's no need to, but do you have a favorite of your dad's albums? Because we've talked about some of your other...
As I said earlier, I tend to enjoy the more warped routines
yeah.
that he did. I liked the King Kong. I mm-hmm. I liked that. I liked Abe Lincoln. I like introducing tobacco, which was a good one. But the ones that I like were the kind of more obscure ones, such as Ledge Psychology.
I know that one, honestly.
Ledge Psychology, the premise is about people committing suicide by leaping off the ledges of buildings.
Mm-hmm.
And the training that policemen go through in order to talk them
okay,
down.
Sure.
And the technique that they're taught is to act completely nonchalant about the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And just to walk out on the ledge wearing a blazer without their uniform
mm-hmm.
and just go, "Hi, how you doing? Got kind of a crowd for a Tuesday. Hi, Steve, yeah." You know, and I just felt that was so warped.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
and for some reason, I really liked that. And another one was A Friend with a Dog, because I felt that a lot of people probably went through that. It's about mm-hmm. a guy who goes to a friend's house, and the guy's got like a Doberman,
mm-hmm.
and it's vicious when the guy's not in the room.
Uh-huh.
And so he's sitting there, "Hi, you fella, how you doing?" You know, and he gives him some candy or something, and as he's talking, he starts to talk about how he was running out of the candy, and he mm-hmm. says, "Well, what's the problem with that?" He goes, "But the dog doesn't understand when you run out of candy." And so he goes through, it's very funny. Those are the ones that stand out, at least off the top of my head.
Yeah. I think that's one thing to make an argument for, if people maybe don't think they're going to like a certain type of comedy. Mm-hmm. That's one of the reasons I do this podcast, is give stuff a chance that you might not think you're mm-hmm. going to like, because no one would expect, everybody's going to remember the lighter stuff that mm-hmm. anybody does, I think, because everybody knows it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you delve a little deeper, a lot of people aren't going to realize that Bob Newhart has a dark side, and yeah. not like a creepy side, but a dark, he's got a dark humor about,
sixth sense,
you know,
of humor.
Of course,
he was linked in with other comics of the period, mm-hmm. where they were all what they called sitcomics, to where they would talk
right.
about, like Dad talking about Abe Lincoln and, mm-hmm. and going to a play. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
that's a sick idea.
Sure.
In the very button-down world of that time period.
Mm-hmm.
And so anybody else who had an edge, like Nichols and May, I believe, also
mm-hmm.
worked that way. So they he sort of got thrown into that. But that's what he found humorous. I mean, mm-hmm. Years later, I was watching A Fish Called Wanda. My dad had mentioned that he liked, and he had gotten us into Monty Python, and I'd listened to the matching tie and handkerchief
album. Of course, yeah.
And all of those. And even before I talked to him about it, he said he'd like the movie and go see it. And he introduced me to, you know, to Holy Grail. Mm-hmm. And before that, when they played on PBS, the Flying Circus, mm-hmm. He loved that and would get us into it. But he when it got to the scene where Michael Palin's character is trying to kill the old lady, but he keeps killing her dogs.
Yeah.
And I just knew that would be the thing that would stand out the most to him and that he would find hysterical. And sure enough, he just thought that was so funny. And so that's the sickness. It's a cheeky sickness.
Sure.
It's not a mean-spirited sickness.
Yeah. And then the other part to remember is for all of his telephone routines, technically, you can make the argument that the darkness is in your own mind because you're filling in all the blanks, and I love that about it. I love that about the telephone.
Well, it's funny. There's a I found people have sent it to me, which is really it's really fun to watch. On YouTube, there's a video of him doing a performance on the Dean Martin Show.
Okay.
Where he's doing Returning the Gift, which is the one about the toupee, to where he's returning the toupee and he's, you know, it had fallen in the dip and he's needs to keep it because the kids want to wash it in the washing machine, but he also wants one that he can wear around. Well, Dean wanted to do it live with him.
Oh, wow.
But
okay.
I had heard, Dad had told me that Dean didn't really like to rehearse all that much. So he hadn't listened to the routine completely. Oh, shit.
No.
And they did the performance, and they're doing it in front of the camera, and Dean's not knowing what to expect and starts laughing.
Oh, shit.
And trying to cover, and you could see it in the YouTube clip where he's looking away or he's looking down, and you could see initially that Dad wasn't sure how to work with it, but then realized, I can play with him.
Yeah.
And then he starts... I think one of the lines was Dean is already in tears and he's trying to get his line out. He goes, "Sir, is there anything I can get you?" And Dad goes, "A straight man with a personality would help." And but he knew that he had him at a certain point and just
so
kind of played with him. But it was very funny to watch Dean he was not prepared.
I have to watch that. That's
fantastic. It's clever.
Have you all right now? You listen to Fire Sign. Mm-hmm. Did you ever listen to like any National Lampoon or Credibility Gap or any of those guys?
I listened to National Lampoon.
Okay.
What specifically, I couldn't tell you, but I would listen to that.
Because only recently I only asked because very recently we covered a Credibility Gap album, mm-hmm. and in it there's a bit where it's supposed to be a KTEL advertisement, but instead of greatest hits. Of music, it was greatest hits of comedy, but covered.
Mm-hmm.
And so, at one point, for a very quick second, one of them does an impression of your dad, mm-hmm. and it's just a funny bit. And I was curious if you've ever heard it, but it's fun. They're doing like intentionally like poor imitations of these comedians. It's quite funny. That just popped into my head. Do you have? So we've already talked about Fire Sign. I just want to go over just some of the other stuff maybe we haven't covered that you were really kind of blown away by. Maybe even as a kid. I mean, were you listening to comedy? How young was he exposing you to new comedy?
The prior albums, I can't remember. I believe it was probably... I was over five. It was maybe when I was seven or so.
Really?
We had seen the albums, but, you know, I can't say the full name of the album. You'll know what I'm talking
course,
about.
Of course, yeah.
Blank is Crazy.
Uh-huh.
But there was that, there was Something I Said was another one.
Mm-hmm.
We just kind of sensed that it was almost taboo.
Sure.
In the sense that we're listening to Dirty Words.
Oh, yeah,
Dad's
yeah, yeah.
letting us listen to Dirty Words.
But that's an unusual story though.
But then later on in life, when I listen to the routines again. Mm-hmm. And things like when he does his I can't remember the title of it, but when he's talking about the wino in the street directing traffic.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay.
If you close your eyes, you can put yourself in that scene, the way he describes it so well. Mm-hmm. When he describes two cheetahs in Live on the Sunset mm-hmm. Strip, mm-hmm. where they're watching the gazelle sitting down in the valley, and he says, "You want to go get him?" He goes, "Nah, man, they're too close." and they're talking back and forth, and then when he says, "You want to go get him?" He goes, "Yeah," and he does a little thing with his hand where he sticks his hand straight out his back, and it. You could almost see it as like the tail of the cheetah, like bolting. And it was really clever. And that struck me much like listening to Jonathan Winters at the end of the Jonathan Winters mm-hmm. show.
Yeah.
Where he would do, especially the pitcher on the baseball mound.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And where he's got all the sounds down. You know. And then throwing it, and the sounds were just perfect.
Yeah,
and I really enjoyed that because I was also a big Looney Tunes fan.
Okay, yeah.
So I love Mel Blanc and all of those, and Bugs Bunny. So anything that mimicked the sound, I would always catch my ear. So yeah. Jonathan Winters and the mannerisms that Richard Pryor did.
Which is probably some of that's born out of like them growing up on radio, mm-hmm. you know, which I think is interesting because you're in a period where you've got TV, radio's not mm-hmm. there.
Just... Well, but see, also my grandfather was an actor and he started out in radio. He used to do those old radio shows like Mr. District Attorney.
Oh, wow.
His name is Bill Quinn.
Okay. I did not know this.
Right. He was, if you remember the Mary Tyler Moore show, mm-hmm. he was Mary's father Mary Tyler Moore show.
Okay.
And one of the last things he did was he was McCoy's father in Star Trek V.
Holy crap.
Which was weird for me because mm-hmm. at the time he was in the hospital for heart failure. Oh, so
yeah.
A whole deathbed scene wasn't what I was really looking forward to seeing. But he had a lot of years before Dad. Mm-hmm, He did the radio shows and then TV. He was Smitty on Gunsmoke.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
The bartender.
Wow.
And did a lot of different things over the years. So I was experienced to being around him with acting and performing. And I think that's where I appreciated if I were to go into performing, looking at it not as sort of like, wow, look at me kind of a thing.
Sure.
But this is a business. This mm-hmm. is, you go there, you perform, you hit your lines, you do what you're supposed to do, you go home. And if there's any recognition beyond that, that's just great.
For sure.
When my mom and dad got married, my grandfather was better known than Dad was at the time because of the character work that he had done.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe it was Bill Daly, because Dad knew Bill Daly before the Bob Newhart show. Mm-hmm. And he was in the wedding party. And somebody said, it may have been Bill, look who they got to play the dad.
I love it.
So he was around. So I was able to see my grandfather's work and my grandfather performing, mm-hmm. And then also Dad performing. I mean, my grandfather more of the actor side, because he used to do the Twilight Zone movies. Mm-hmm. He was in the Twilight Zone movie, the Steven Spielberg episode Kick the Can.
Really?
He was the old guy who thought it was wrong for them to want to become kids, and then very end he's crying at the window.
Wow.
That very final scene where he's sitting here kicking the can in the yard.
Mm-hmm.
So
my goodness.
So yeah. So he'd done a lot of work over the years.
Yeah.
But I was able to see his side of it where he played more of the straight dramatic roles, and then Dad playing the comedic roles.
For sure. And and the only thing, like I said, is like I feel like when you grow up in a household with, again, I grew up in a family where people treat it as a skill. I feel like you have more appreciation for it.
Yeah.
Again, rather than, hey, you know what, son, I was given this thing. I do what I want with it. You know, you feel like some people do get that impression. They don't understand how it works.
Yeah, he never we never took it seriously.
Yeah.
I think we accepted it for doesn't everybody's father perform on stage at night and then go to sleep at 2 a.m. right. and then get up the next day and then work in the evenings? That's only until we moved away from the house and saw other people's careers did, or at least for me, did I realize starkly the difference between the two. But for us, it was, it wasn't the celebrity of it, it was the work involved in doing it, the studying, the training, the thinking. Dad always cracking open the newspaper first thing in the morning and looking for stories to come up that would trigger something. And just ideas would come in the weirdest places. He had mentioned at one point that I went to school up in Spokane, Washington. I went to college in Spokane, Washington. And one of the times that he was up there visiting for family weekend, he happened to be in an inn in Spokane.
Oh, really?
And that's where the idea for Newhart came
that's
from.
That's so great. That's so good. I love it.
The Barry Kemp thought it would be a richer target for characters if it was in Vermont, but Dad actually wanted it to be in Spokane.
That's
but,
funny.
But he would he would come up with ideas and what ifs in the and that's where the routines came from. Is if you could get the audience to buy the premise, then you can go from there. So when he would set up his routines, such as King Kong, everybody's experience being trained for a job, and then the first day you're on the job, you're thrown into something where you have no experience whatsoever, and what do you do? And then decided to marry that. What if you happen to be the security guard on the first night where King Kong climbs the building? And once you get people to buy the premise of your first night there in King Kong, then they can go along for the ride. And so that was the premise on a lot of, or that was the setup on a lot of the different routines and different jokes that he did.
I wanted to just skip back to something you were talking about earlier real quick, just because it involves your exposure to it. I was really shocked to hear that you were that young listening to Richard Pryor and that it was cool, because like so many people have had to sneak, like I've had friends who are maybe 7 or 8 and they say, yeah, no, I had to sneak this album because it was filled with dirty words. I love that it was like, no, this is fine, because
I can't remember. I mean, I'm not trying to get him out of trouble
no,
or anything,
of course.
But I can't remember exactly what age it was.
Sure.
It was youngish, but it was youngish to where we knew that we were listening to something to where, okay, if Mom knew that Dad was letting us listen to this, she probably wouldn't be happy.
I love that.
But but we knew the albums were there. I can't say specifically that my brother and I would sneak those albums. We did definitely look through them. I mean, I'd looked through those albums countless times at the different ones, different choices that he had picked in regards to what he wanted to listen to. But when he specifically introduced us to something, specifically Pryor, was wow. And it was, I think at the time, it was more listening to something that we weren't supposed to listen to.
Of course, yeah.
But then later on, going back and appreciating the storytelling part of it, which is really what made it, I think, fascinating for Dad, because he didn't obviously have the life that Richard did. Richard had a much more difficult life. And to almost live vicariously through it, but to live it in the sense that Richard wasn't morose about it, that he could make light of it. And do it in a funny way to you. You still felt the hurt, but at the same time, he also made it accessible.
Yeah, that's a really good point. It's nice to hear. It's actually not dissimilar to if you love Warner Brothers stuff. It's different in that you're uncovering stuff later, like, oh, that was meant to be. Mm-hmm. It's a lot more subtle. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of cool to be exposed to something. It's like, oh, this is this. Because I'm pretty sure I had my parents, like, growing up, they would let me watch a movie that had sex in it, but not violence, you know. So eventually it's like, oh, that's silly. But then eventually, like, oh, this is pretty good. Although, I don't know, The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas is a great movie. But it's definitely one that let me watch when I was really young. I thank you very much for coming here and talking
to
me. And if you ever want to, honestly, you mentioned so many albums that we haven't even talked about. If you ever want to do a specific one and come back, please let me know.
Sure.
And especially, I want to talk to you about something about Fireside after Firesign when we're done. But normally I say, why recommend this album? Since we're not talking about an album, let's just say go listen to Bob Newhart. Let's go say watch Heart and Souls, because that is a really fun movie. It's a silly little movie, but it's a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. And it's worth a listen to. And yeah, well, thank you for being here so much. And thank you guys for listening. And as always, have a good thing. Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. Please visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, read our blogs, read our tweets, watch our videos, and read our books. Please subscribe on iTunes, and if you like us, give us a 5-star rating and a nice review. You can find us on facebook.com/comedyonvinyl, Twitter @comedyonvinyl, and find everything else at comedyonvinyl.com.
And there are people running around, you know, with various assorted pans of one kind or another, with worried looks on their faces. And I don't think they're nurses. They're just people that are hired to run around looking worried, because this makes the father feel better, you know, that they're concerned. And then they have the father's room. It's sort of a torture chamber that they've devised to drive the father nuts while the wife is having the baby. And this is filled with guys you just wouldn't believe. You know, they're all sitting like that. And there's one guy in there who has just had a baby, and he is superior to everybody else, you know. He's sort of gloating, you know. And, of course, I'm trying to get information out of him, you know, and I say, gee, they just took my wife into the hard labor room. Like, what will it be, 15, 20 minutes, I guess? No. So, no. Oh, no. Oh, 5, 6, 7 hours. He says, you see that poor guy over there in the corner? 32 hours he's been here. And there's a guy in the corner, he's not making any sense at all. He's going, mom. So as I say, I don't know how the world ever got overpopulated, because we swore we would never do it again. But it has a happy ending, because we had a little son, Robert William, and he was 7 pounds, 14 ounces.